I want to acknowledge our university and community supporters. The University of Iowa's Honors Program, the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, and the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization for their financial support. And I also want to thank today's special sponsors, Midwest One Bank, Alan Swanson Bank and McCune Realtors, and Mason K. Braverman. At this point in time, though, it is my pleasure to welcome Chad Hart. Chad Hart is an extension economist and associate professor of economics at Iowa State University. Chad is a native of Southwest Missouri. Growing up on a rural homestead near Stark City, Missouri, he tells me there are probably more people here in the room today than lived in his hometown. He received his PhD in economics and statistics in 1999 from Iowa State University. His work has concentrated on crop marketing, crop insurance, international trade agreements, and bioenergy policy. Chad is also a partner in Farm Risk, an Iowa firm that develops revenue insurance products for agriculture. Over the course of the past couple of years, there have been a lot of conversation about international trade and the benefits and costs from it. From the renegotiations of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, to the volley of tariff announcements between the U.S. and China, international trade policy is in a state of flux. That uncertainty has direct and indirect impacts for the Iowa economy, as Iowa and the U.S.'s agricultural sector has developed to meet international needs. In this discussion, we will explore the current set of trade agreements, disputes, and organizations, examine how Iowa agriculture fits into the global economic system, and outline the benefits and costs from international trade. Please join me in welcoming Chad Hart. Thank you.
So how was lunch today? Good. Glad to hear it. As you can tell by my accent, no, I'm not from Iowa. But yeah, we're going to talk agriculture today. And I like to lead off with this slide behind me here, because it basically shows the world. And what you're looking at here, the colors on the map are indicating, if you will, the soil quality from throughout the world. And really what you would like to see when you're looking for agriculture is you're looking for those green spots. Because those green spots are highly productive soils that are highly resilient, that you can farm over and over again. When you look at our entire planet, how many big green spots do you see up there? Not many. I'd give you three. And I think that's the issue. When you're looking at agriculture, even though it is a global industry, if you will, it is highly dependent upon few key regions. And we just happen to live right in the middle of one. And so when Ed Zastrow reached out to me this spring, he said, okay, I've got three topics I want you to cover. The weather impacts we're seeing on agriculture right now, the tariffs and the trade disputes we're seeing there, and the possibility of trade deals. And I said, Ed, are you giving me 2 to 3 hours to talk? He goes, no, 45 minutes. I'm like, that's a lot of territory to cover. So bear with me. I'm going to try to cover all of this as best I can and try to answer your questions there at the end. But I'm going to start you off with what a farmer tries to do. Now, in this case, this graph may be a little hard to see, but it's a graphic that sort of, if you will, explains what a farmer is trying to do with when they're trying to grow a corn and soybean crop here in Iowa. What we've got here is, you can see these blue bars here. Those are the last freeze of the wintertime. The ones down here on this end are that first freeze we have in the fall. And so a farmer, if you will, is trying to wedge that crop production in between those two freezes. And they're highly dependent upon the weather cooperating in order to do that. In this case, this curve you see going up here is a measurement of growing degree days. Does the weather cooperate to allow that crop to grow, mature, develop in time to beat that freeze? And that was the big question this year. In a normal year, we're trying to plant right after that first or last freeze of the wintertime, and then hoping that that crop matures right before we get to that first freeze in the fall. What we had happen this year sort of pushed us back a couple of weeks. And that two-week gap has been hanging over agricultural production this entire year because it delayed not only the planting of the crop, It delayed when the crop emerged from the soil. It has delayed the development of the crop, and it's delaying the harvest of the crop. And so as you're traveling around the state of Iowa, the best way I can describe it is the crop would look really good if it were the 1st of September, not where we're at today. That's the challenge farmers are dealing with right now, because now it looks like that crop could be getting at maturity right when we typically face our first freeze. The challenges here, though, weren't just from the weather this year. I want you to think about, as farmers are looking at the development here, they're making this decision on the planting the year previous. And what farmers were looking at, in this case, this is a very dangerous time for me and for you here in this audience, because now you're getting an economist explaining a weather map. There's only two subjects where you can be wrong more than half the time and still have a job. These are the two, economics and meteorology. But what you're seeing here, this was the precipitation last fall. And so in this case, for those of you who can't see it, anything in red to the yellows, that would be below average. As you get to the greens and especially the purples, you're well above. What did last fall look like? Noah could have built an ark. The idea is, especially as you look at this strip and then going through here and in the east central Iowa and all the way along the coast, we did see incredibly wet conditions last fall. Those wet conditions set us up for the delays we saw this year. Because what they did was it started this period of rainfall filling up the soils, getting them to, if you will, peak saturation, where they're holding as much water as they possibly can. And then as we went through the wintertime, the idea is here's January through March. Notice still a lot of purple there. We just continued to see that moisture build up. And that's what created the flooding that we saw last spring. And to tell you the truth, we're still having a hangover from that impact. In fact, I was watching the news last night, and part of the discussion over here was the possible flooding of I-29 over the next week. And it's a continuation of what we have seen is an incredible amount of moisture come in over the past year, year and a half, and we haven't really had a period of time to try to dry a lot of things out, even though we've actually had some dry periods. For example, as we were getting ready to go into the fields, we were seeing very wet conditions. Then a lot of folks were like, okay, April comes. Normally, this is when we'd start planting. You can see fairly dry across most of the state, but the idea is the soils were already saturated. And so even though it was dry, it was not dry enough. They could not get the machinery out in the fields to cover the vast acreage that we try to plant here. When you think about a state like Iowa, we've got 36 million acres that we cover in total. Two-thirds of that acreage goes into crop production. In order to cover that much land, you have to have machinery that can move fairly quickly through those fields. That's the thing they could not do this year. Because while April was dry, May was definitely not. And so we saw a few farmers get out in the fields at a normal time. Most of them were delayed at least 2 weeks, if not three. And those delays have created some significant problems for our farmers as they're looking at the upcoming harvest season. Because the delays in planting mean delays in harvest. And the thought process of, will they be able to get that crop before the freeze hits? Will it fully develop? When you're looking at our planting progress, and this is nationwide, we weren't the only ones suffering through this problem. In fact, when we look across the entire spectrum of U.S. agriculture, we're seeing delays everywhere we looked. In fact, Iowa is in fairly good shape in comparison to some other states. But you're looking here, in this case, this blue area here shows you sort of the average range of planting progress throughout the countryside in terms of corn here. The red line is what we did this year. So compared to the last 40 years, which we have data for, this was the slowest planted crop we've ever had. And so definite delays here. And when you look at this gap here, that tells you it's about a 2-week gap for the vast majority of the crop. And again, it wasn't just corn where we saw this impact. Soybeans, same tale. Barley, oats, cotton, same tale. Because the idea is this wasn't just happening in Iowa. And it was a challenge not only because of the wet conditions getting out in the field, but it was also, let's face it, if you think back to last spring, it was a little cooler than normal as well. And so when the farmers could get that seed out in the field, then the problem became, okay, how quick will it emerge? We saw those same delays. In fact, even more so as you look out there. Now, the beauty of biology, especially crop biology, is that crops can make up some gaps in time. When you think about the corn crop, it is highly sensitive to the conditions of weather that we have throughout the growing season. The warmer the growing season, usually the quicker the crop grows. That comes up to a point, though. The idea is that you can get too warm, and then the plant starts to die back down again. But this crop is needing to make up 3 weeks. And I'm going to argue it's made up about a week and a half. And so we're still a good week and a half to 2 weeks behind in terms of the development of this crop, in terms about being able to say how much we'll be able to produce. And that's really the first challenge that farmers are facing this year, irrespective of all the market challenges that they're facing right now. In fact, as you look at the weather forecast coming up here, the idea is that we're looking at another possible wet fall, setting us up for these same types of problems again as we look forward next year. And again, it's not specific to one crop. Soybean emergence, same problem as we look out there. Now, as we went through this growing season, again, did we find some dry periods out there? Yes, it was quite interesting to watch Mother Nature turn the tap on and off. As we went into June, very dry conditions, especially across western Iowa. And in fact, it was actually fairly beneficial. When I'm looking at where in the state do I see the best crops this year, believe it or not, it's western Iowa. The dryness here in June helped those crops send those roots down deeper into the soil, so they're a little more resilient to variable weather conditions. Now, July, we saw that dry pattern move over here. But by that time, if you will, the crops over here in eastern Iowa, by July, your root set's already pretty well set. And so the crops are a little weaker here in the western or eastern side of the state because of that. And as we move through August, a little mixed bag. But when we're looking at weather conditions and setting up on the production side, what we have seen throughout the countryside is this, and I'll apologize for this right off the bat. Usually when you see a red versus blue map, you immediately think politics. Don't go there. So in this case, what happens in the way we sort of track agriculture is that USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, each month does a survey. Well, actually, two types of surveys. One is a farmer survey. They literally ask farmers, what do you think your production will be like this year? What will your crop yield? At the same time, too, though, what they do is they select random fields throughout the country and go back and visit those fields each month over the course of the harvest season and evaluate what the crop's looking like. And if the crop's far enough along, they actually harvest some to estimate what our crop will be like. This map is indicating what they have seen and what they've heard from farmers thus far as we look at this year. The red states are states where they are lowering that estimated yield on the crop. In this case, the top number that you see in each state is the estimate of yield in the state. The bottom number tells you the change. If you see states that basically look white here, the idea is that states that, you know, you'll notice that bottom number says NC, no change. So they're holding the estimate steady there. And then states in blue are where we're seeing an increase in yield. When we look at the damage that's happening this year, arguably you can see a lot of red over what we would consider the corn belt. But notice, especially as we're looking here, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, it was the eastern corn belt that had a much rougher time than even we did here in Iowa. The wet conditions delayed them by 3 to 4 weeks. And in fact, when you're looking across the countryside here, over the entire nation, there were roughly 20 million acres this year that were not planted at all because of the weather delays. In a normal year, that would be more like 3 to 4 million acres. So it's almost like, if you will, almost like the state of Iowa disappeared from production this year. because of the planting problems that we had. Then you put on top of that the challenge of the acres that did get planted are going to yield less than we've seen over the past few years. In fact, as you look over here to the far right-hand side, there's the U.S. estimate. Right now, we're staring at 168 bushels per acre, which would be what I call a good crop, but not a great one. In fact, I would describe agriculture this year sort of like I would describe the Iowa State game this year. It was a rough one to watch. It had to deal with a lot of weather. One team barely won, the other team barely lost, and neither team wants to talk about it. That's what agriculture's facing right now. It's not a great year. It's not a terribly bad year. We're sort of floating in the middle, and realistically, we just want to get through the year. And again, it's this question of, you know, it's not just on one crop that we're seeing this dilemma. Soybeans, same tale. In fact, when you're looking here, even though these are small changes here, these yields compared to last year across the eastern corn belt are roughly down 15 to 20%. Significant cuts in production. So farmers are finding a challenge of one, they'll have less crop to sell. But at the same time, too, they're finding that their prices aren't necessarily offsetting that loss. And that takes us to topic number two, the tariffs and the trade aspects of this. Now, showing you some pictures, now I'm going to dazzle you with some numbers. Yeah, consider this the back of the baseball card when you're thinking about agriculture. What I've got for you here, this is sort of just a number sort of spreadsheet breakdown of when you look at the corn crop here in the U.S. How do we actually get it, and then what do we do with it? So in this case, the top section here, that's the supply side of the market. How much do we plant here in, you know, million acres? What's our yield? The big number here is the production line. How many million bushels or billion bushels of crop do we grow each and every year? And then you'll notice a stock level here. So between, if you will, each growing season, we carry some of the last crop over to make sure that we have enough for the next year. Well, when you're looking at these crop years across here, and what I've got are basically the, let's call it the actual data for the last 4 years, and then the projection for this year's crop. So what we're looking at for this year's crop, that yield of 168 bushels, that means nationwide, we're looking at maybe producing 13.8 billion bushels. That's a lot of corn. But compared to years past, it's actually somewhat small. In fact, when you're looking at these five crop years as they stand right now, you are staring at the five biggest corn crops this country has ever seen, even with the problems we've had this year in getting it planted. Farmers are amazingly efficient, even in bad weather years, at producing crops now. And arguably, that has been one of their biggest challenges as well. Because agriculture was struggling economically even before the trade dispute started. In fact, if you go down here all the way to the bottom line here, that's where I've got the season average price. What's the average price a farmer receives for a bushel of corn? And when you look at those prices, notice they've been almost fairly flat, if you will. The trade problems really started in 2018, yet you don't necessarily see things getting any worse, but they're not getting better either. For farmers, the trade dispute has been more insult on top of the injury that the ag economy was already facing before it started. In fact, if I could go back in time, 2014, that would have been another big crop. Actually, when you go back, the last seven corn crops are the seven biggest this country's ever produced. But you go back the year before that, 2012, drought year, we had prices that were twice as high as what you're seeing today. So farmers have seen a whipsaw in prices over the past few years. But for the most part, it was a whip down really hard, then followed by fairly flat, low prices that continue today. Now, the part I skipped over here was this box in the middle, and that's the demand side of the market. And that's where I want you to especially pay attention to that export line, because that's where we're fighting this trade dispute. Now, I've led off with corn to show you that, in this case, it's not just all about China. When you think about the corn market for us, China is actually not a big buyer of U.S. corn. In fact, they buy very little U.S. corn. But when you look at what the trade dispute has done the past couple of years, it has cut out about 10% of the demand that we typically see from the international marketplace. In fact, I'm going to argue USDA's numbers are too high as we look forward to this year's crop. One of the things that we can do on the agricultural side for exports is we can sell the crop before we've produced it. You have advanced export sales. We do a lot of that each and every year. In this case, those advanced sales are down about 50% compared to a normal year. And you can link it all to the various trade disputes that we've been through. Because, again, it's not just China. When you think about what we've had over the past 2 years, it's been disputes with China, the European Union, Mexico, Canada. The list goes on and on.
Did you say 15 or 50?
50.
50.
So cut them in half. That's a significant challenge. Because when you think about most of our crops, and again, I'll go back. Think about that first map that I showed you. There's three big green spots throughout the world. What that tells you is when we're looking at agricultural production, those three big green spots tend to produce excess product so that it can be shipped to all the other areas. What we're seeing is that demand from other areas has basically been cut in half due to the trade disputes right now. So it's not just China where we're seeing these problems. It's across all of agriculture. It's really highlighted for the state of Iowa in the soybean market. Because when you think about our two crops, I'm going to argue corn is produced more for our domestic use. We use roughly 80%, 80 to 85% of everything we produce on the corn side. Soybeans, though, no. We used about half and we shipped the rest of the world about half of that crop. And before the trade dispute started, 60% of our exports went to China. Or to flip that around another way, 30% of our entire production in soybeans went to China. We were highly reliant upon that market. And what had been happening for this market, as you can sort of see it here as you look at the acreage, in 2015, we planted 83 million acres. That went up a little bit in 2016, went up to 90 million in 2017. We were growing more and more soybeans because we were finding more and more demand. But where was that demand coming from? It was the overseas markets, and specifically, it was China. And so U.S. farmers were adjusting their production practices, making different crop choices based upon this idea that trade was going to continue to build and grow, especially with China. And so when the tariffs hit, what you saw in this case, you can see a much more of a price impact here for the soybean market, because when the dispute with China hit, it definitely took that market out. And in fact, we've watched those sales to China. First, they were reduced by half. Now they're down about 70%. But believe it or not, China is still our number one market for our soybeans. Even after all those cuts, they are still our biggest customer. It was fascinating to watch, if you will, how intertwined the U.S. and China have been in this market. The U.S. is the world's largest producer of soybeans. China is the world's largest consumer. And we were sort of tied at the hip over the past decade until this trade dispute started. Now both sides are scrambling to try to figure out how one replaces the other. And the way it's happening right now is what you're seeing is a grand scramble within global agriculture. Because what I'm going to tell you is that when we look across the globe, it hadn't just been the U.S. that's been producing very large crops over the past few years. Actually, global production has increased quite dramatically. In fact, when you're looking here at the numbers for 2018-19, those estimates, the world total there is the largest the world has ever seen. What we had been experiencing, at least globally in agriculture, was a tremendous boom in international demand and exports, from not only from the U.S., but all across the globe. Now, as these trade disputes are erupting, there's a lot of product, in this case corn, soybeans, that is searching for a home under this uncertain trade environment. And it's leading to some interesting things happening. Now, the general storyline is this. When you look at global production, the idea is if you look at the U.S. total there, we typically are roughly a third of the world's corn production. You're going to find the same thing when I go to the soybean chart. The difference here between the two markets is this, though. When you look at the rest of the world in terms of production, the idea is there isn't one other really dominant producer that's also an exporter. In fact, the closest one to us in terms of production, if you go all the way down here, is China. And in this case, they tend to be a net importer of corn. But most of the corn that they're pulling in actually comes from Russia and the Ukraine, a little bit closer to that market. And so as we're having these trade disputes, the idea is that other countries searching to source more corn, but not from the U.S., they had a litany, a menu, if you will, of countries that they could approach, but no one country could replace the U.S. It's a little different when you're looking at the soybean market. Here, the general story is the same. The world in 2018, biggest soybean crop the world has ever seen. The U.S., roughly a third of production. But unlike corn, here there is a very strong challenger to, if you will, that number one position in terms of world production, Brazil. And so what we saw when the trade dispute really broke out between the U.S. and China, point out a couple of things. One, when the tariffs first started hitting, you'll notice we went through several rounds. It's like the U.S. would put on some tariffs, China would put on some tariffs. But soybeans was never one of the products that China hit until things really, for lack of a better term, hit the fan. Until we started talking about tens of billions of dollars being put under tariffs. It was only then that we saw China move to put tariffs on U.S. soybeans. And that's because when you're looking at China, I'll take you back here again. The corn, they produce a lot of corn. I want you to look at that soybean total. Notice how small that is in comparison. The idea is you look at the Chinese agricultural system, it was also based upon sort of the trade flows. They have sort of moved their agriculture to specialize in certain crops and to rely upon the rest of the world for others. So in this case, they produce most of their corn, most of their wheat, a fair amount of their cotton, and a lot of their rice. Other crops, like soybeans, no, they rely upon international trade to bring those supplies in. Now, with the tariffs in place, they're looking to change that. In fact, what we're hearing out of China is that they may double soybean production over the course of the next 2 years in an effort to try to replace what they lost when the tariff war hit. They also went to Brazil very strongly into that market and said, we'll buy all the soybeans you can produce. Do you think Brazil responded to that? Well, the idea is they are expanding. In talks that I've had with Brazilian groups over the past 3 weeks here that are visiting Central Iowa, yes, they're going to see a lot more soybeans planted down there in response. And so right now, agriculture is going through a game of musical chairs in terms of trade, figuring out who's going to be able to trade with who and at what price. When you're looking at the tariff dispute, tariffs are basically a tax. They're a tax on imports. They're a tax on doing business with another country. And what I want to point out is they're a policy instrument, but they're considered a fairly crude policy instrument. We have used them in the past, and other countries have used them in the past, to reduce trade and protect domestic industries. In fact, the original argument, sort of the precursor to the trade war with China, was the steel and aluminum tariffs that President Trump brought up about 2 years ago. And his argument for that was to protect the domestic industry for our national security. Tariffs aren't necessarily a good or bad thing. I'm going to argue they have, again, positives and negatives along with them. when a tariff is put in place, it's usually positive for the domestic producer of that product because it's protecting that industry. It's negative for the domestic consumers of that product. So in this case, when China put that tariff on soybeans, it was good for their producers, hence they're increasing their production over the next couple of years. It was bad for their consumers. And if it's specifically targeted against a certain country, like the tariffs with China, between the U.S. and China are, the idea is I want you to think of, you know, when it's pitting one against the other, it's specific to that country's consumers and producers that you think about here. So again, I'll go back to the soybean tariffs here. It's a positive for our country's consumers. They've seen lower prices because it's backed up those supplies here that used to go to China. But it's been a negative for our producers. In a game here, and let's face it, as an economist, I have to show you at least one chart that shows supply versus demand. The game is this. The tariffs change the price level. And because of changes in price level, what that does for us here, you can think of this as we're putting on a tariff. And this is where we were before the tariff. So we supplied some, we imported the rest to meet our needs. You put a tariff on, that increases the price, the cost. What does that do for producers? Well, since the price is higher, I'd like to produce a bit more. But consumers see that higher price and they want to consume a bit less. And so it's a way to constrain how much you have to import. And it has definitely worked that way when you look at the tariffs that have been shot across the bow from both countries. Now, looking specifically at this example, like I say, it's been a positive for Chinese soybean producers and for our soybean customers here in the U.S. For the U.S. consumers here, facing a lower price. For the producers over there, facing a higher price. Well, flip it around. It's been bad for our producers, good for, you know, their consumers. And so when we're looking here, the idea is that it does two things. Price effects to create supply changes. Less soybeans going into China, more soybeans left in the international marketplace, a lower price here. We're going to see Chinese producers look to grow more soybeans. We're going to see U.S. producers look to grow less. And we definitely saw that this year. In fact, if you bear with me here, I'll go back. And when you look at acreage this year, notice the big drop. 13 million acres just in soybeans alone. Some of that driven by weather, but I'm going to argue most of that driven by the trade problems here because of how big China was to this market. Now, like I say, tariffs are a policy tool. We've heard the president, you know, talk about how this is, you know, reducing trade deficits. It can. It doesn't guarantee it, though. In fact, when you look at the data so far through this trade war, actually our trade deficit has gotten larger. Because what we have seen is sort of, I guess I'll call it inconsistency in whether the tariffs are coming or not. It's a strange tango we're going through right now. I describe it as two steps forward, two steps back. We'll see the countries agree to hold off on tariffs for 2 weeks, and then after 2 weeks they decide to put them on anyway. And so because of that, what we've seen is, let's call it a flurry of sales trying to beat when the tariffs come in. And that has actually increased our trade deficit as opposed to reduce it. Now, does it raise government funds? Yes, it does. Now, the president is big on saying that China is paying that. Now, I'll go back to a tariff is a tax on imports. Who actually pays the price to bring that product in? The consumer. So ultimately, who's paying the tariff? No, that's bearing down on the consumers here in the U.S. of those products. It's made to protect certain industries. It definitely does that. And can also be, you know, used as a bargaining chip. And that's definitely the way President Trump has approached this. As he's using the tariffs as that blunt tool to say, we want changes in other types of policies from China. We don't want changes in their tariff policy necessarily. In this case, our dispute with China has to do more with the way they approach property rights more than it is about tariffs. the big concern here has always been intellectual property rights and how they're handled within the Chinese economic system. President Trump has decided to get them to, how do you force them to change? Well, I'm going to hit them over the head with tariffs to sort of put the pinch on their economy and hopefully put enough pressure to get them to change their mind. Now, this is not a new strategy. We've had tariffs on many goods before. In fact, when you look over time, the idea is that the U.S. has had major shift in tariffs, and I won't bother to read all the years. The idea is that this has been done before many times. It will be done again. Typically, you know, and I can say this with complete certainty, we have never seen a trade war of this size or scale before. So this is a true experiment on just how far can you push the tariff boundaries here. To give you some sort of idea of how far we've been in the past. In this case, what we're seeing here is this, you got two lines here. The orange is basically just showing you what we call on durable inputs, those things that can last 3, 4, 5 years in terms of those goods. The blue line shows on total imports. But what you're seeing here is the average tariff rate. And you can see here, we started out back in the 1820s and 30s around 50%. We've eventually worked our way down to where the U.S. is a relatively low tariff country. On most goods, 3 to 5% tariff is what we tend to see on our products. Now, there have been a lot of things that have happened here, and you can see sort of the laws that go along with this. One of the big things I'll point out is the Hawley-Smoot tariff back here in the 1930s. And some have argued that was the thing. It didn't create the Great Depression, but it certainly helped it last for nearly a decade. And the idea is coming out of that, we saw things like the GATT system. The GATT is the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And it basically laid out sort of an international framework to help countries negotiate through trade and trade policy. And one of the big recognitions of coming out of basically the Great Depression and after World War II was this idea that trade does tend to benefit both countries involved. There's not necessarily a winner and a loser from trade, because what trade allows individuals, industries, countries to do is to specialize in what you do relatively better than that other country, industry, or individual, and allow them to specialize in what they do relatively better. Guess I'll argue case in point when you look here at State of Iowa and our Regent universities. The idea is when you think agriculture, you typically think where I'm at, Iowa State. When we think medical, you tend to think University of Iowa. Why? Because those specialties have developed over time, and it makes sense to concentrate on those so that you don't have everybody trying to do everything. And you see that same sort of evolution when we look at how agriculture has evolved over this same period of time. You think back, and we like to have this image of agriculture where it's that small family farm that does a little bit of everything. It's a nice setup, but it's not a very economical one. Because what we've figured out over time is that some farmers are much better at growing crops. Others are much better at growing livestock. And in fact, we benefit when they sort of specialize. We see the same thing in other industries. And that's what we've done. Now, when looking at the Iowa economy, I'll point out that, you know, agriculture, while it's a, we consider it a big part of our economy, direct agricultural production here in Iowa is only worth about 4% of our GDP. But it helps drive some of the others. So when you think about it, our biggest one is manufacturing, but who's the biggest manufacturer you can think of in the state? John Deere. Thank you very much for playing. When you're looking at real estate, for example, most of our real estate, what would you think it is? It's agriculture. Again, two-thirds of the state gets planted to a crop. When you think about government, our largest department is the Department of Agriculture. When you think about finance and industry, one of the biggest sectors there, crop insurance. And so while ag is a relatively small direct piece, it has indirect connections throughout the rest of the Iowa economy. And one of the things that we did in looking at the trade dispute at Iowa State is looked at these interconnections. And when you look at how the Iowa economy has changed, we do still see growth in the Iowa economy, but it has slowed over the past couple of years. And agriculture is one of the main factors or main reasons why we're seeing that drag on our economy, and that's coming from the trade dispute. Now, other sectors, and this is where I will sort of pick on manufacturing, and let me think here, what else? Probably the construction there. You have seen some boost there. Again, when some of these tariffs went in place, it was protecting some of the industries there. If you were in steel or aluminum, you got some extra protection. That helped boost the GDP coming from those sectors. As we look forward into trade, though, the problem's going to be this, and this is one of the things that's unique about agriculture. Overall, the U.S. tends to run trade deficits. One exception is agriculture. Again, going back to that map and those green spots, we're one of the few places in the world that can produce a bounty of agricultural products. And so we tend to have a significant trade surplus in agriculture. With the trade dispute, that surplus has completely disappeared. For the first time in 50 years, we may actually import more agricultural products than we export. And it all comes back to handling those trade relationships, and in this case, the fall off of that relationship with China. But it's not the only place where I've seen that sort of drag. When you look at, in this case, I've got it broken down between China and the red line. Our free trade partners are in the blue line, and then everybody else in the world's in that green line. And so you can see here where we've lost it is in the Chinese market and in those other countries where we don't have some sort of trade agreement in place. Trade agreements loom large for agriculture because we tend to see strong markets develop. In fact, when you look at who our biggest trade partners are now, China used to be number one. They are now number five overall. They're still number one for us in soybeans. When you look at our top two, Canada and Mexico. That's why NAFTA and the USMCA agreements loom so large. Number three, the European Union. President Trump has talked about creating a trade deal there. Number four, Japan. We're well on our way to having a trade deal there. And then number six, South Korea, where we have a free trade agreement there as well. But you're talking about overall, you know, roughly $130 to $140 billion worth of trade happening within agriculture, mainly because we are a fairly large producer. When you look here at these ranks, we're always in the top five in terms of agricultural production with almost any product that you pick. But when it comes to trade, we're in the top two. We are like the world's grocery store. The idea is we produce a lot of agricultural products that, let's face it, are meant to move. In fact, let me show you that map again. Again, when you're thinking here, you want those green spots. That's where the excess agricultural production that helps feed the rest of the world comes from. And we've got our industry designed and built to do that. So looking forward, I think what you're going to see is a strong push that we've seen a lot of, let's call it trade destruction. The question is, when do we start to see some trade creation? That's where the deals come in. And I'm going to point first and foremost at one that Congress is facing right now, the USMCA. It is basically NAFTA again. In fact, 70% of the language is exactly from NAFTA. There are some changes to a few key commodities, in this case the biggest one being the automobile industry, but we did see some changes in agriculture as well. Dairy will do a little better under the USMCA agreement. But for the most part, this deal is about consolidating trade that we already have. Again, Canada and Mexico are already our biggest customers. This just makes sure that continues. Because when you're thinking about it here, the idea is the numbers are up there. You're talking about $40 billion of agricultural trade. Roughly 28% of all the products we ship out go to those two countries. And when you translate that back into jobs, you're talking about well over 300,000 jobs that just that trade deal supports alone. I think looking forward, and this is where I'm going to watch President Trump very closely here, is how he creates new deals. The biggest one to watch for this year will be Japan. We don't have a free trade deal with them. We never have. We're working on one now. They are a big customer for us again, so this is more of a trade deal of holding trade flows as opposed to building new ones. But right now, that's the stage that we're at in terms of trying to rebuild our international trade portfolio. We've seen some destruction. Now we're trying to stabilize it out in hopes of growing as we go into the future. All right, so I've sort of sped you through those three topics in about 45 minutes. I just about hit that right on one. So I'll stop.
This question is, wouldn't CRP help farmers and the environment?
It would. The biggest challenge, I think, when you're looking at programs like CRP, goes back to something I did not touch on, the federal budget. When you're looking at programs like CRP, the biggest challenge to them that they face right now is finding enough room in the budget to help expand those. Over time, what we've seen in CRP is we know the environmental benefit, but it has come at a fairly significant investment of the U.S. budget. In fact, when we look at the overall agricultural spending, roughly 10% goes into conservation programs. And in a tough budget environment like we're facing now, the idea is we have seen the environmental programs get squeezed. With one exception, I'll take you back. In this case, it was our most recent farm bill. We did see the administration propose more money into CRP, allowing more land to be enrolled in it. We had gotten down to about 24 million acres across the nation in CRP. We're going to be allowed to increase that up to about 29 million acres. So it will help, if you will, the production issues that we have by helping pull some land out of production. But it's not something that's, let's call it a long-term help. In fact, one of the biggest challenges we have seen since we started CRP back in the 1980s is a definite loss of market share when it comes to international trade again. As we cut down our production for CRP, it is being replaced by production in other countries. And so the price benefit that farmers might receive by that reduction in supplies gets negated when we look at the world marketplace. And so it's a tool that we like to have, and I would argue it's a very good tool for us to use for multiple benefits, not just thinking about the marketing side, but more importantly, the environmental side of the ledger here. But it is not the... It's not the best tool in the toolbox. It's a good tool when used effectively.
We have a lot of good questions. I'm going to try to put a couple together, which is two of these are basically, what is the impact of the China swine fever on soybean market or other diseases to the demand for soybeans?
Okay. And so with African swine fever, I'm going to approach this in two different ways. It has been a boon to the hog industry, and it is a problem as we're looking forward at soybeans. The reason China was buying that many soybeans from us was to feed their hog industry. The Chinese hog industry is massive. You know, here in Iowa, we like to think we are large in hogs, and we are. But the idea is you could take the U.S. industry, take it times six, and it's still probably a little small for what China produces. African swine fever has been an incredible dilemma for the Chinese hog industry. Estimates, and trust me, you just have to take estimate guesses here. We're looking at 20, 25, 30% reduction in their herd. Or to put it another way, they've lost the entire U.S. hog industry through this disease. It has presented some significant challenges for them. And one of the biggest one being, when you think about especially meat demand and meat usage in the various countries, China's meat, if you will, profile is a lot different than here in the U.S. Here in the U.S., you can divide it up fairly roughly in about 40% of the meat we eat is going to be poultry, 25% would be around pork, about 20% in beef, and then you add up the rest in seafood and other various, you know, meat, veal. When you look at China, 85% pork. That's why they were producing so many hogs. Pork is the staple protein for them. And so, you know, and recently we've talked about here in the U.S. with the strike that happened to Saudi Arabia, there was talk about opening up the strategic oil reserve. Well, in China, they have a strategic pork reserve. And they are opening that up. Because, yeah, it has had a tremendous impact on them. And the problem looking forward, and especially for the soybean market here, is that, let's face it, if those hogs aren't there anymore in China, that means that's feed demand for the product that's gone. And how quickly will it come back? Well, if they don't have the disease under control yet, they can't rebuild. And so you're talking about a loss of global demand here that will go on for years. On the flip side of this, the pork industry here has seen our exports to China actually increase by over 1,000%. And that's with the trade war going on. That's with the higher tariffs in place. That's another sign that tells you that African swine fever is having an incredible impact on the Chinese economy and marketplace.
Well, to follow up on that answer, too, this might be a good one to ask about. It says, if the tariffs are lifted with the market, will the market return to pre-tariff prices? But then it says, Iowa farmers are hurting. How are tariffs a positive for them, for things for them? And I would add in then, maybe for pork producers, though, it's different. Is that right?
It is. It's vastly different. As we're looking here, if the tariffs were to disappear tomorrow, no, we will not return back to pre-tariff levels. The tariffs have been in long enough that there have been some significant structural changes that have happened that will not allow things to return back to where they were. The U.S. and China will never quite be in that relationship again. Trade, especially international trade, it has to do with having products, yes, but it's also about building a consistent relationship. It's amazing how international trade still hinges on handshake deals, how you have to have confidence in that person on the other side of the transaction. And what the U.S. had built since World War II is we were seen as one of the strongest, most consistent suppliers on the agricultural side that the world had. That confidence is now shattered because our trade policies are changing literally at the speed of Twitter. And if the tariffs were to disappear tomorrow, that doesn't take away the threat that they couldn't reappear 2 days down the road. And so that holds things off here, that we won't see necessarily that recovery. Now, when looking at the tariffs, if you're looking at this from a positive, from the farmer's perspective, I'm going to argue what farmers are looking for, hoping for, is the one they would tell you they don't want trade aid. They would prefer trade, but they would prefer, let's call it more open trade. Lots of farmers voted for President Trump in 2016. They will likely vote for him again in 2020. Because what they're looking at is, yes, the trade dispute has hurt them and the tariffs have hurt them greatly. But what they're hoping for is that there is a payoff. And in this case, will China adjust its trade rules to be more in line with the international community? If they do, then you could argue there's a positive there for farmers moving forward. But it's betting on the come. It's betting on that there's an agreement somewhere down the line. And I think that's a challenge for a lot of folks here. As we're looking here, in fact, I got to admit, you know, the last three or four media interviews that I've done have asked me that sort of question. Farmers have voted for President Trump in the past. Do they continue to support him? The answer for the most part is sort of yes, but it's that balancing act is now much more closer to even than it ever was. Because remember, most people don't just vote on one issue. And when we look at the general economy, while we have worries about it, it's still growing. And when you look at some of the other issues that the agricultural community has cared about, President Trump has more positives on that ledger than negatives. His biggest negative that he deals with farmers is what's happening, well, one, with trade, two, with biofuel policy. But there's enough on the other side that it helps balance out for more conservative farming communities.
Is there any indication that the tariffs have moved China closer to a deal on intellectual property rights?
The answer to that is we don't know. When you think about the announcements that have been made throughout this trade dispute, basically what we get is we think we're getting closer to an agreement, or nope, we're not, and we're putting on more tariffs. But we've never seen actually any sort of outline of what a deal will look like. It's really hard to say that what sort of policy changes China might make. And in fact, we're at the stage of the game where I'm going to argue we won't likely see major changes over the next few years. If we're going to see a deal, it's going to start off with just reducing the barriers we've put up over the past two. And we'll probably end up doing that over a 4 to 5 year time period before we even get to thinking about the broader issues. One of the things that I did not mention, but I should, is when you think about a trade deal, especially one of the scale that we're looking for from China, those don't just come together in weeks or months. They take years, if not decades, to create. When you think about the USMCA, people like to point out, well, that was renegotiated very quickly. And I'm like, yes, but the vast majority of it is still NAFTA. How long did it take to create NAFTA? 14 years. It takes a long time to create a worthwhile trade agreement. We're 2 years into the process with China. Realistically, we should be prepared. It's going to take another 12 to finally get to this, call it the crux of the matter, the heart of the issues that the two countries have with each other in terms of their various trade policies.
This is a little more specific, a little different, but why haven't the federal projections been more pessimistic about total production?
So I get this one a lot, actually, from farmers. So if you were to look at those projections, the idea is what USDA does. They have a very, I'll call it, systematic way that they estimate yields. And I just sort of described it. There's two pieces. One, they survey farmers, just literally ask them, what are you going to get for yields? And the other is to go out into the fields. The reason USDA hasn't been more pessimistic is because farmers keep telling them the yield potential is still out there. And I'm going to agree with that. Like I say, when you're looking at this crop, the problem is not that the crop's not out there. It's a question of whether it will mature in time or not. The potential is there. And USDA's methodology is to basically say this. We look at the crop as it stands today, and we assume that it reaches maturity. They do that every year. And that's why that number is higher than some farmers would like to see. But again, I can turn around and blame those same farmers, because when they fill out the survey, that's exactly what they also tell USDA. So, as I mentioned, they update these numbers every month. One of the things I've been watching and preparing for is that USDA is starting to work that yield number down, and it's because farmers are working their own yield number down based upon the delays in development of the crop. They will do it again as we go forward here in October. They'll do it again in November. We actually don't get the final number until January. And so I expect this thing to slowly work its way down to the correct number.
Well, there were several other good questions, but I'm afraid we're out of time. So I will encourage you, though. Professor Hart was actually on River to River on Monday on Iowa Public Radio, and you may be able to go listen to that, and as well as he's taping the Iowa Press on Friday evening. So you have an opportunity to hear a little bit more on this topic if you want to. But unfortunately, we must conclude our program at this time, but I want to give a big thanks to Chad Hart for his wonderful presentation. And he managed to get all three of those topics in the 45 minutes, which was pretty amazing. So I also want to thank our sponsors, the University of Iowa's Honors Program, the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, and the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization for their generous support. And we also thank today's special sponsors, Midwest One Bank, Alan Swanson of Bank and McCune Realtors, and Mason K. Braverman. And we thank City Channel 4 for making our programs available to viewing audiences. So, Chad, at this point, though, I want to give you your second, I believe, very highly coveted Iowa City Foreign Relations Council mug as a great thank you for your presentation today. So, thank you very much.